You're listening to Podcaster Practice, brought to you by Springer Healthcare IME. Podcaster Practice brings you expert-led independent medical education discussions, inspiring healthcare professionals to maximize their learning and make measurable changes in their own clinical practice. This podcast is part of an independent medical education program entitled Improving PBC Outcomes by Prioritizing Patients' Needs and is supported by an independent educational grant from Ipsen.
Hello and welcome to this vodcast on primary biliary cholangitis. I'm Chris Cowdley, director at Liver Institute Northwest and professor at Elson S. Floyd College of Medicine, Washington State University in Seattle, Washington. Joining me today to discuss the current therapeutic landscape and recent advancement in PBC management is Professor Dave Jones. Hi, Dave. Let's jump right in. Let's start by providing the audience with an overview of the current therapeutic landscape for PBC. Please introduce yourself and your affiliation.
Well, thank you very much, Chris, and thank you for inviting me to join you. I'm from Newcastle upon Tyne in the UK at the University of Newcastle. I'm a professor of liver immunology, and I've been working in PBC since the early 1990s. We manage around about 1,000 patients in Newcastle, and I've got a great interest in how do we best manage people, and particularly around symptoms. So it's a great time to be talking about this because there is a lot happening. And I think the landscape is emerging. Clarity is coming to where we go with this. We are very well established, I think, now with a step-up treatment model. So we start all patients on ursodeoxycholic acid, but we are critically looking at whether they respond to that therapy adequately. And where people aren't responding adequately, then we're looking to use second-line therapies. There's obeticholic acid, which is the currently licensed therapy. And then there are two emerging therapies called elafibranor and seladelpar, which have just completed phase three trials, which is making the whole field very topical. I think those drugs are going to be an important part of our landscape for therapy. And I think it's going to be very interesting to work out which of these drugs we should be using in different patients, which is the right therapy for individual people. But the most important thing for all of us is to remember that pretty much everybody who doesn't respond adequately to ursodeoxycholic acid will benefit from second-line therapy. So it's key to think of those options, but it's also then important to think what the right treatment is. So a time of real change, but also important progress for patients, I think.
Well, that's a great introduction. And as you mentioned, two major phase three trials were completed. The ELATIVE trial and the RESPONSE trial with elafibranor and seladelpar, respectively. Let's get into a little bit of detail on the recent studies that were presented at AASLD in late-breaker sessions from these trials and their implications for clinical practice. We know that both had a significant response in terms of improvement in alkaline phosphatase to less than 1.67 times upper limit of normal, with at least a 15% reduction and maintaining a normal bilirubin at differences to placebo that would range from 41 to 47%. And that's very impressive. Furthermore, I think what's novel about these trials is that we're seeing alkaline phosphatase normalization, you know, at a rate that we have not seen before with obeticholic acid. So with that as a very high level summary, how do you think the results of these trials compare to previous data on PBC treatment? And let's focus on second line therapies added to ursodeoxycholic acid.
So I think you make a very important point that we are beginning to see what I think is going to be the next stage in this journey, which is looking to normalize tests. So we've used cutoffs of abnormality for adequate response to ursodeoxycholic acid. And I think there's been some emerging data from the big international groups that look at PBC to show that perhaps we have ended up not treating people who actually do have some residual risk. And I think in the field, the direction of travel is going to be towards looking to normalize the test. And I think most of us feel that's going to be the case. I think that will also simplify the sort of message for clinicians thinking about managing PBC. So increasingly, trials and therapies will be looked at in terms of how they normalize the tests. And we're seeing now appreciable percentages of people returning to normal who were non-responders to ascorbic acid. I think that's really important. I think a really important second aspect of the trials is the information about itch. So a big focus of my practice is about the symptoms that PBC patients experience, the impact on their lives. And one of those is itch, a particularly unpleasant, deep under the skin itch, which can be really quite disturbing. It can have a big effect on people's quality of life, and it impacts on sleep. So people feel fatigued and leads to social isolation. So a really unpleasant symptom. And controlling itch is something that's very important for the patient. And I think what both of these trials suggested is that these classes of drugs have a beneficial effect on itch. And that's perhaps a little bit different to obeticholic acid, which certainly doesn't benefit itch and, in fact, can make it worse. So for patients who need second-line therapy who've got itch, these seem like a really positive step forward. So that's going to be an important factor in making decisions. And then the final thing for me is that these drugs really appear very safe. I think that's very important. We are looking at a group of people who are going to need long-term therapy. This is a chronic disease. With the best will in the world, we can't cure it. And so long-term control. So yes, there'll need to be more information about longer-term use, but they both appear very benign in terms of their impacts on patients. So I think for all of those reasons, we're looking at a potentially important step forward.
That's a brilliant summary and extremely well put, highlighting the fact that with these new therapies, we're seeing not only improvements in alkaline phosphatase to a greater degree with the goal of achieving normalization now within grasp, but also favorable effects on itch and potentially favorable effects on lipids. What do you think are the challenges in adopting these medications into real-world clinical practice, and how do we educate clinicians to do that in a way that's meaningful?
Well, I think that's a great question, and I think it is a challenge. And I think there are two specific challenges about where we go next with these therapies. The first is around regulatory approval and showing definitive effectiveness in terms of survival and avoiding death or transplant is really difficult when there are already second-line therapies around. And I think there is going to need to be a sensible dialogue with regulators about how we show benefit or effect with drugs that very clearly benefit patients in terms of the things that all clinicians use all the time to monitor these diseases. So that's going to be the first hurdle. I think that will be solvable. I think there's going to be a discussion around all of that. We will move forward with it. I think the other challenge is then going to be complexity. And I think in the field, we have made it complicated. Things like the cutoffs of alkaline phosphatase for response to therapy. There are a number of different criteria for those levels that different people use. It just feels complicated. And I think obviously we will potentially have three licensed therapies for second-line treatment. There will also be fibrates available in some jurisdictions. We certainly have them in Europe. And so we're suddenly going to be faced with a choice of therapies for patients. And I think simple guidance about who to use them in is going to be really important. So I have a saying with my fellows that you spend the first half of your career making things more complicated, and the second half of your career making them simpler again. So I'm well up for a mission of making all this as simple as we possibly can. Simple guidance for clinicians about which treatments to use in which people. So there's more work still to do because at the moment, we're not seeing these drugs used as much as we should do. And I think that complexity is one of the problems. So our job isn't quite done yet.
Excellent insights and really useful given your enormous clinical experience and your contributions to the field. Are there other upcoming trials or emerging therapies that clinicians should be aware of?
So PBC has been a very live area for trials, and I sometimes have to pinch myself. When I first started in PBC, there were no therapies. This was before ursodeoxycholic deoxycholic acid even emerged. And for a rare disease, the coming together of the patient groups, the academics and industry to really make a difference has been one of the most extraordinary journeys. I think there are two directions in the future. I think there's going to be a major push around symptoms. So at the moment, we're talking about symptom control in people who happen to need second-line therapy. But what about the patients with itch who actually have quite well-controlled disease with URSO? So there are a number of trials of therapy specifically looking at itch as a target and also fatigue. So I think that's going to be very important, adds additional tools for managing patients. They have their own regulatory challenges, but I'm sure we'll be able to cross those. I think the second area is going to be around combinations of therapy, because the two big classes of drugs, the PPAR agonists and the FXR agonists, so elafibranor, seladelpar are PPAR agonists, and obeticholic acid is an FXR agonist. They appear to be synergistic. And when you use combinations, you then appear to have even higher rates of normalization. So I think that's going to be a very interesting journey, although that will add even more complexity. And then my personal view is that really the final iteration of all of this will be to look at primary therapy again. So how do we first treat people with PBC when they're diagnosed? At the moment, we treat them with ursodeoxycholic acid, and then we look to treat those who fail with second-line treatments. But that allows the higher-risk people to have time over a protracted period of time where their disease gets worse. And so looking at better primary therapy in the higher risk patients, I think will be very important. And I have a sneaking suspicion that the best answer for symptoms in PBC is going to be prevent them from happening in the first place. And so ultimately, I think some of these drugs that are now emerging ought to be thought of again as primary therapy. And that's where this issue of safety and tolerability is so important, because these are drugs that I think you can conceivably in the future think of as first-line therapy. So I think that will be the final iteration of the current sort of range of interventions. In the future, we would love to be able to cure it. I don't think that's on the horizon at the moment, but I think complete control from early in the disease course is absolutely achievable.
Well, thank you for that fantastic summary. And I really like your discussion about the step up versus step down or step up concept, which is for those of us that are old enough, we remember the olden days of H2 blockers and PPIs, and there were the debate about starting with less effective therapies and then going to more effective therapies. And I wonder whether that kind of concept is going to take hold in the future. But regardless, you've given us a tremendous insight into the current landscape. Several new therapies that are on the verge of getting approved, and we should be able to offer to our patients, and also some valuable insights into the future and how we might really be able to treat PBC empirically and prevent symptoms and complications rather than treat it after these have developed. So I want to thank you for sharing some time with us. It was a pleasure to have this discussion with you. And to our viewers, thanks for tuning in. We hope you found this conversation informative. And bye for now.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for listening to Podcast to Practice, brought to you by Springer Healthcare IME. For more information on our educational programs available, visit ime.springerhealthcare.com.